We continue the Shi'ur in Gemara. Gemara says Rabbi Chama once also went to the yeshiva to study for a period of 12 years' time. After the 12 years were over, this was seemingly a given set time for students to study the yeshiva. They had their classes around for 12 years. After 12 years, he decided to return home, and he said, I don't want that this should happen to my wife, what happened to the wife of Rabbi Hananya ben Hachinai. When he dropped in suddenly to see her, the sudden shock caused her to pass away. So I won't shock her suddenly. I won't surprise her. I'll do it gradually. He went to the yeshiva, and he sent word to the house, a messenger, someone to tell that her husband is home. He's coming home soon. This wouldn't be that difficult to take. While sitting in the yeshiva, a young man came in, Rabbi Oshia. This Rabbi Oshia was his own son. He had no idea this was his son because when he left, his son was a child. This young man came over to him, and he sat down close to him. They started to discuss learning Torah. And Rabbi Chama saw this young man was so sharp, such a great chacham, that he immediately felt brokenhearted. And he said, imagine if I had only stayed home. Instead of going to the yeshiva for 12 years, I could have had a son like him now. I would have been here. I would have taught my son to it. I would have had a son who was such a great gaon. He felt very badly about this. Finally, he went home. He sat in his house. His wife was very happy to see him, of course. After being there for a while, his son came in, this same young man, Rabbi Oshia. Rabbi Chama saw him, he jumped up. His wife said to him, since when does a father stand up for a son? Imagine his joy when he found this young man whom he so envied. He envied the father, this man found it was his own son. Even it says that this is what King Solomon says. One is strong, but possibly weak. Two is stronger. One helps the other. The triple is something, a thread, where you have a combination of a rope of three threads combined, that cannot be torn easily. In other words, if you have three generations of Chachamim, Tamidei Chachamim, then a person's assured of having a steady family tree of learned people. Who was his three generations? Rabbi Oshia, the son, Rabbi Chama, the father, the one who just come home, and Rabbi Chama's father, Rabbi Bisa. Three generations of great Chachamim. Why are these three mentioned? No, specifically, because the fact that Rabbi Chama was not home, how come that his son became so great? Because his own father, that means the son's grandfather, adopted this son, cared for him, and taught him Torah. That's how he became so big a Chacham. Why did the grandfather take such pains as teaching his grandson? Because the Gemara tells us that anybody who teaches his grandson Torah receives credit as though he had stood at Mount Sinai and received the Torah from there. So big a mitzvah it is, teaching grandson. Just as we have the mitzvah of Ishinatan Levanecha, mitzvah to teach your son Torah, we have an additional mitzvah for a grandfather to teach a grandson Torah. The reward for it is as though, the credit is as great as though he had stood at Mount Sinai and received the Torah there. Now we come to what's possibly known as the most famous story in Shas. Perhaps the most outstanding story in Shas, the story of Rabbi Akiva, his inception into Torah. Why is the Mikiva's story so important? It's a lesson that teaches any person who has had the misfortune of not being brought up the family of Torah, parents to teach him Torah, was not had the opportunity, whether it's financial or social assistance, to be able to become a Talmid Chacham, that all is not lost. There is still great hope for him. Rabbi Akiva is the classic example, because Rabbi Akiva was the greatest of the rabbis in the Gemara, the only one who ever could be compared to Moshe Rabbeinu. The Gemara says, what was the beginning of Rabbi Akiva's life? How did Rabbi Akiva begin? Rabbi Akiva was the shepherd of Kalba Savua. Kalba Savua was one of the three wealthiest men in Yerushalayim. By wealthy, we mean multi-millionaires. As wealthy as he was, so great a tzaddik he was, so charitable, so philanthropic. He had hired Rabbi Akiva to be his shepherd of his cattle. Rabbi Akiva at the time was comparatively illiterate. He knew how to read barely the Aleph Bet, he could read the Sidur, but he had no knowledge of Torah at all. He served as Kalba Savua's shepherd, and he was 40 years old at that time. The daughter of Kalba Savua, whose name was Rachel, saw Rabbi Akiva, and she recognized in him very pure and sincere tendencies. She could see this was a very delicate neshama. She came to him and said, I am Kalba Savua's daughter, and I am offering you myself as a bride, as a wife, on condition that you will leave immediately after the chuppah, the wedding, and go to the yeshiva to study Torah. Rabbi Akiva immediately accepted. Marry so wonderful a woman, the daughter of the richest man in Yerushalayim, plus the fact that her whole hashkafa, her whole outlook was not to marry a man who was wealthy or a man who had special standing in the community, but to marry one with the sole intention of seeing that he merged to that. Rabbi Akiva agreed, and they were married secretly. And as soon as her father found out, he disinherited her and fired Rabbi Akiva from his position, and made sure that no one would give him any financial assistance. His daughter was left penniless, and so they had nothing, no money of any kind. They were forced to live in a barn. All they had in the barn was some old straw, by which they could lay. Rabbi Akiva felt badly only for his wife's sake. He had nothing to offer her. Poor they were. Here she had been living in a comparative castle, the greatest luxury imaginable, and now she's got to live with clothes that are becoming tattered, and without any food, without any furniture of any kind. The only bed they had was a little straw. Suddenly there was a knock on the barn door. Rabbi Akiva opened it. There was an old man standing there. This old man, the Gemara says, was Eliyahu Hanavi, who came disguised. Akiva asked him what he wanted. He said, I'm very poor. I want you to help me. Akiva smiled and said, I'd gladly do it, but I have nothing. I haven't got a penny to give you. Literally, if I had one penny, I'd give it to you. If I had a piece of bread, I'd share it with you, but I have no penny and no bread. The old man said, I'm not asking for that. I'm asking only for a little bit of straw so I could lie down. He said, that I can give you, gladly. He took some of the straw and gave it to this old man. The old man took it and disappeared. The man says, why did this happen? To sort of encourage Rabbi Akiva and his wife. Encourage them to show them that they are not the poorest people out. Here's someone who's even poorer than you are, who doesn't have even straw to lie on. Then the Gemara says that Rabbi Akiva said to his wife, if I would have money, you're so wonderful at what you're doing, what the sacrifice you made. If I'd have money, I would buy you a golden crown. I mean, women have different types of jewelry. But they wear sort of a crown, a band around their hair, around the head. A band of gold is called Ir Shel Yerushalayim. It's called a Jerusalem gold crown. If I had money, I'd buy it for you. She said, I don't care about that. All I want is that you keep your word. Go to the yeshiva and study. Rabbi Akiva left. He went to the yeshiva. Av, Rabbi Eliezer HaGadol, who was his main rabbi, Rabbi Yeshua. There he studied 12 years, as was customary. At the end of the 12 years, he was ready to go back. This time, the Yeleta says, there are two opinions in the Yeleta. One place it says, Rabbi Akiva came back alone. The Yeleta and Adani. The Yeleta Ketubot says, Rabbi Akiva came back with 12,000 students. 12,000 students is so great, a tzaddik, a rabbi, he became, he developed to such an extent, came back to Yerushalayim, but he came back without fanfare. He was not yet recognized as so great a leader. When he came through the back end of the barn, and as he was about to enter the barn, he heard his wife talking to someone. Before going in, he decided to eavesdrop, or he couldn't help eavesdropping and hearing what the conversation was about. He was curious who it was. He heard the voice of a man there. He recognized the voice, that of an evil man, known evil man in Yerushalayim, who spoke to his wife, said, why do you stay with, married to your husband? He's deserted you. What good is it to be married to one who you don't see? Why don't you go back to your father? Tell him that you will accept a divorce from Rabbi Akiva. He'll take it back into his house. After all, he's brokenhearted because when he disinherited you, he wasn't that bad-hearted. Out of the heat of anger for what you did, he vowed, he made a vow, a neder, not to give you 1 cent of his belongings, of his wealth. And therefore, he cannot help you with 1 penny. All these years, do you think your father is happy seeing you suffer like this? At best, you take inside the washing of old clothes from some neighbors who have pity on you. Look at how you dress now. Torn clothes. Why don't you go back to your father? Break off this marriage. Husband has gone on for 12 full years. Is that a life? Rabbi Akiva waited breathlessly to hear a reply. She said to this man, my husband, Rabbi Akiva, has been gone 12 years. For my part, I'd be very happy and satisfied if he stayed away an additional 12 years, as long as he is studying Torah. Rabbi Akiva did not enter the barn. He silently moved off, returned to the yeshiva where he had been studying, and stayed there for 12 more years. Total absence of 24 years from his wife. But at the end of these 24 years, Rabbi Akiva had now become the Rabbi Akiva, the chief rabbi of Eretz Yisrael, the greatest tzaddik alive, the famous leader of the Jews, rabbi of all the Jews, so famed that now on his return to Yerushalayim, all Yerushalayim came forth to greet Rabbi Akiva, who was coming in a special parade leading 24,000 rabbis as his students. There were now 24,000 great rabbis who were his students. The city turned out to greet, to give kavod, so great a tzaddik. The leader of the welcoming committee was the leading member of the city, Kalba Savua, who was his father-in-law. Kalba Savua had no inkling that this Rabbi Akiva who was coming was really his son-in-law. But what he was anxious to do, he wanted to see this great Chacham to ask him if he could somehow solve the problem for him by removing this vow that he had made not to give his daughter any financial aid. He felt so hurt all these years of seeing his daughter suffer. He thought perhaps Rabbi Akiva would be able to find a loophole through which he'd be able to remove this vow. It's called Hatarat Neder. And he waited until Rabbi Akiva came, and then he approached Rabbi Akiva. He gave him the proper kavod, the proper honor that was due the chief rabbi of Eretz Yisrael. He said, I have a problem. I wonder if you could help me. My problem is that I once made a vow many years ago, a vow not to give one penny of my property to my daughter. The reason was that I didn't want her to marry an Am Haaretz at the time, an illiterate. She married him against my will, and that's why I made the vow. Is there any way legally this vow can be removed? And Rabbi Akiva said, we have to have a reason to show that the vow itself was an error. If we can prove the vow was an error, then we could remove the vow. Now let me ask you this one question. If you would have known then that your son-in-law would eventually become a rabbi like myself, for example, would you have made the vow? Kalba Savuas looked at Chas v'Shalom. Rabbi like you, if he become a thousandth, a millionth as great as you, I'd never have made the vow either. But he could never become anything. Rabbi Akiva said, well, how do you do, father-in-law? Kalba Savua just about fainted on the spot. And, of course, he asked Mechila from Rabbi Akiva. Rabbi Akiva removed the vow. And the Kalba Savua gave Rabbi Akiva half of all his wealth, which, of course, made Rabbi Akiva extremely wealthy. Now, continuing along on this parade, riding on this coach, the streets were lined with people. Thousands upon thousands of people came to see, to feast their eyes, to be zoche, to look at the tzaddik. That's no small item. It is so great. Rabbi Akiva had a student, one of his students, later years, was Rabbi Meir Balanes. Rabbi Meir Balanes had a student, Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi, the chief rabbi of the Gemara, the one who compiled the Mishnayot. Rabbi Yehuda once made a statement and said, the reason I am so great is because I was zoche to see my rabbi, Rabbi Meir Balanes, once to see his back. If I would have seen his face, imagine how great I would have been. It shows how important it is to be zoche to see the face or the eyes of a tzaddik. So here, people came forward to see, to gaze upon the holy countenance of Rabbi Akiva. Among those who filled the streets was Rabbi Akiva's wife, came forward to look at this tzaddik. And there are two opinions again as to what she thought. One opinion says that she knew this was her husband. The other says that she did not know. Now, her friends told her, how do you expect to go look at this tzaddik the way you're dressed? Torn clothes, it's a shame for you to go out and be seen by him. And she replied, he is so great a tzaddik that surely he will not embarrass me. This was according to the opinion of the Yemeni that she did not know was her husband. Second opinion says she knew, and she replied, a tzaddik can recognize his animal. He can recognize the soul of his animal, meaning that I am only his servant, like an animal is, but he will recognize me anywhere, even though he's been away for 24 years, and he'll take me close to himself. Of that I am certain. The Gemara says that as the Bikiva's coach passed along the street, his wife Rachel ran forward to the Bikiva, and she fell forward at his feet and she started to kiss his feet. kiss the feet of a tzaddik. The students who were running close to him, acting as sort of bodyguards, rushed to push her away. Rabbi Akiva yelled out and stopped them. He said, "Don't dare, because you see this vast amount of Torah that I have learned, this vast amount that I have taught, all that I have learned, and all that I have taught, and all that you have learned, the entire credit is hers. It is her credit, only because of her, was I zoche to go out and study all these years, to go out and teach all these years, and to come back as I am. It's all due to the credit of my wife, Rachel." Yemena says that Rabbi Akiva had a daughter. This daughter, of course, extremely fine, brought up the same as her mother. And in order to select a chatan for her, he picked out his best student at that time. It was not actually a student. It was sort of half student and half chaver, friend. His name was Ben Azai. Ben Azai was one of the four who visited heaven together with Rabbi Akiva. And of course, Ben Azai was the one of those four who refused to leave heaven, and he passed away while in heaven. But he gave Ben Azai his daughter for a wife. And the Yemenis says that, like mother, like daughter. This is where the statement comes from. The exact words, like mother, like daughter. Ki'ima, kibita. Just as the mother had done for Rabbi Akiva, so did the daughter do for Ben Azai. She agreed to let him go off to study Torah for an unlimited period of time. Question is, of course, the Tosafot asked the question that we find before mentioned when the rabbi spoke to Ben Azai, and they said to him, there are some who Tadush very nicely, they baksha very nicely, and there are some who perform mitzvot very nicely. There are some who do both. You lecture nicely because you speak about the great mitzvah of getting married and having children, yet you do not fulfill this mitzvah. Ben Azai answered, true, but what can I do? Nafshi chashkeba Torah. My soul craves Torah so much, I am married to Torah. I cannot take time out to be married. This was his answer, and the Shulchan Aruch says that he was justified. Every person must get married unless he is that great a shakdan. Shakdan means diligent in the study of Torah without stop, without pause. Like Ben Azai, then and only then is he excused. But no one who can compare to Ben Azai, no rabbi in the Gemara is called a shakdan, diligent in the study as Ben Azai was. However, we see from there, Ben Azai said, the others said that he was not married. How do we find here the fact that stating here that he was married? Tosafot answers that it is true that he was not married. They became engaged. After the engagement, Ben Azai left and went to study Torah and never consummated this marriage. But Akiva's daughter was so pure, like her mother, that she was willing to let her husband, her intended husband, to go off and study Torah, and to live with that knowledge that she has even an intended husband who would be that pure in the study of Torah. The other potential possible answer is that he did get married, and afterwards he had left her. In any event, of course, he did not have any children. That's why he's called Ben Azai, but not his full name. His full name was Rabbi Shimon Ben Azai. Because he did not have any children, therefore, he's called only Ben Azai, not by his own name. Yemena says that the Rava was one of the later, much later rabbis in Yemena. He had a son, Rabbi Yosef, and he too was about to get married. And he got married with the intention of going to study Torah for 6 years. To return after 6 years. At the end of 3 years, on Erev Kippur, he decided to come back to his home. Though the 6 years was not up, he decided to visit his home just for this day, but he made sure to come back Erev Kippur, which was to prove that he's not coming back because he has a desire for a physical desire for his wife. Because the law is that on Kippur, the night of Kippur, husband and wife must be separated as though she is in Idah. So this was conclusive proof that his intentions were not for that sake at all. Despite this, the fact that he came home 3 years before the time so angered his father, Rava, that Rava took a stick. He came running towards him and he said, "How do you dare to come back? You're in the middle of learning, you're reminding yourself of your wife, of your dove." This word dove was put in, injected to show that he knew that his son of Yosef was pure, because the Gemara says that of all the animals and birds that exist, no animal or bird is pure in the sense that it has its mate. Animals are not husband and wife. Each animal is free, roams about, and has no set mate. The same thing with birds. The only one is the dove. The dove adheres, sticks to its own mate, and refuses to mate with any other but its very own. This, the dove, is the only loyal, let's say, loyally wedded bird of all the animals of birds. That's why the Knesset Yisrael, the Jewish nation, as a symbol, is called the dove. The dove is the symbol of peace, too, and that it's pure in this respect. So as I said, you came, you reminded yourself of your wife, your dove, meaning that there is purity here, but still, how do you come to think about your wife when you're supposed to be studying Torah? And the argument became so intense that this was just before Kippur, they had to eat the last meal. They became so involved in the argument that both of them, father and son, both missed eating that last meal. They had to go into Kippur hungry without the last meal. So, speaking about Rava, the Gemara says that these two, Rava and Abaye, were the two most famous later rabbis of the Gemara, among the Amoraim. You find them throughout the entire Shas, the entire Talmud mentioned more often than any other rabbis in the Gemara. Rava was married to the daughter of Rav Chisda, very great tzaddikit. Abaye passed away before Rava. Now, the rule is that a person who is poor comes before the Bet Din, the Hebrew court, the chief rabbi, and asks for financial assistance or for food. The wife of Abaye, whose name was Choma, came to the yeshiva of Rava, the chief rabbi, and asked him to give her food. So he said, all right, he wrote out an order that she's to receive from the regular funds this amount of food. So she said, no, I want you to add to this wine. I want a regular supply of wine. Rava said, how do you come to ask for wine? I recall knowing Abaye, I know that Abaye did not drink wine. How come that you have, that you drank wine, or that you want wine? You're accustomed to it. So she answered, well, let me tell you, Abaye would give me wine in cups as large as this. She held her arm out to show, and as she did, the sleeve fell back, and the lower part of her arm was revealed. This Choma was such beauty. Beauty generally is coincides with the word radiance. A beauty shone so that when her arm was revealed, the room was filled with brightness. The fact that her arm became exposed. When the lad saw this, he jumped up and he ran home. He came to his wife, the warden of Gestad, and he spoke to her. Looked at her and spoke to her. The reason was that so that he should not have the thought of any other woman, the possible thought, we're speaking about great Sadiq Qutb, not to allow the possible thought, tiniest iota of thought of a different woman, he went to look at his wife and to know that he's satisfied with his wife only, not to think of the sly as a different woman. But his wife suspected something. She asked, how come suddenly you came home? Tell me, who was in the bet-din today? Who was in the court today? Who was there just now? So he said the wife, the widow of Abaye, came to ask for food. Abaye's wife picked up a heavy block, metal wall, and she went to the court. She started to swing at Abaye's wife. She started to chase her. She yelled, you killed three husbands. Now you're coming to this city to find a fourth one to kill him? She drove her out of the city. Of course, it's important to note that Abaye's wife, true that she had married three times prior to this, to three great rabbis. Abaye was the third one. And it tells about Abaye's problem, should he marry her or not. He was advised not to because the Gemara says that a woman who was married twice, but both husbands died, that woman is called a killer. Not deliberately, of course, but her mazal is that her husbands die. A person should not marry a woman whose two husbands have died. Abaye did, because there is a safek, there's a doubt, there's a machloket, whether this applies to a woman who's had two husbands die, then she's called a killer, or that takes three. Of course, in his doubt, he decided to marry her, and of course, the result was that he did pass away. Now, she herself, of course, was a tzaddiket. It wasn't physically her fault, it was just that mazel. But the Avan's wife was anxious to see that she was withdrawn from that city, that no fourth person should fall into this bad mazal. And this could have even applied to Deva himself, because in those days it was customary to marry more than one wife. This is why she removed her presence from that city. The Gemara says that Yochanan ben Zakkai was one of the greatest students of Hillel the Elder. Hillel has a kid. Yochanan ben Zakkai was the rabbi of Rabbi Eliezer HaGadol, who was in turn the rabbi of Rabbi Akiva. Yochanan ben Zakkai lived at the time of the Churban Bet HaMikdash, when the Roman Empire attacked Israel, attacked Jerusalem, time with Aspasianus, the first king, and then ultimately his nephew, King Titus, Machshemur, who broke into Jerusalem, destroyed the Beit HaMikdash, and drove the Jews into exile to Galut to this day. Yochanan Zakkai was the one who influenced the King Aspasianus to let the rabbis remain alive, that the Torah should continue to flourish. At that time, the Gemara says, when the Romans were besieging the city of Yerushalayim, there were three very wealthy people in the city. One was Kalba Savua, the father-in-law of Yakiva. Second was Akdimu Ben-Gurion. Akdimu Ben-Gurion was a very holy person for whom the Gemara says Akdimu means the sun shone especially for him. But one day the sun had set, and then because of his tefillah, the sun rose up again. He was also a second wealthy person, and the third was Ben Tzitzit Akset. These three were so wealthy that they could supply nourishment, necessities for the countless millions of people living in Yerushalayim at that time. That's how wealthy they were. Of course, the youth at that time, the impetuous youth, fighting youth of Yerushalayim, did not want to make peace with the Romans. They went against the advice of Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai. And in order to incite, expedite war, they set fire to the warehouses of these three wealthy men. And this, of course, brought the war to its climax and the downfall of Yerushalayim. Now, after the Churban, the Yemenis said sometime later that Yochanan ben Zakkai was riding on a mule. He was riding on a mule leaving Yerushalayim, and his students were walking along behind him. Suddenly, he spied a woman who was standing among the animals of the Arabs. Arab animals, bending down between these Arab animals among the dirt, picking out just drops of oats. It's the lowest type of food, animal food, but selecting them from among the dirt. Which meant that she was that poor, she had no food to eat, and she was that desperate, she would take these oats, these dirty oats, home to try to wash them and to make some food out of them. When this woman saw Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, she quickly covered her head in respect. She came before him, stood before him, and she said to him, "Rabbi, please feed me. Give me food." Yochanan ben Zakkai asked her, "Whose daughter are you? In other words, you look familiar to me." She said, "I am the daughter of Naktimo ben Gurio, one of those three multimillionaires." Yochanan ben Zakkai asked her, "Well, where is all that money your father had? Where did it go to?" She answered, "Rabbi, you know, as a saying in Yerushalayim, three words, Melach, Mamon, Chasid, salt, money, gone." Which means, if you want to salt your money, just as you salt meat to keep it, to be able to stay, if you want to salt your money, the money should remain with you, you shouldn't lose it, then chaser, get rid of some of it. How? By giving tzedakah. If you give tzedakah, you ensure that the money you have left will remain with you. If you fail to give tzedakah, that money is not salted, it could dissipate, it could disappear. That's what happened to my father's money. Of course, there was not enough tzedakah given. Money went, it's gone, completely. Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai asked her, "What about your father-in-law's money? He was wealthy too. Where is it?" She said, "That money was mixed together with my father's money. One had the bad mazal of getting lost and dragged along the other one with it." Then she said, "Rabbi, do you remember you were at my wedding? You signed my ketubah, a marriage contract. You recall the marriage contract?" Yochanan ben Zakkai turned and said to his students, "I recall very clearly, when I signed that contract, I read in that contract, it said that the father of the bride gives cash, 1 million gold dinarim, as a gift to the couple, in addition to the amount that the chatan brought in for his father as the requirements of the ketubah, Tosefot of the ketubah." That's how wealthy she was at the time of her wedding. Yochanan ben Zakkai then burst out crying, and he said, "How wonderful the Jews are. When they fulfill the command of Hashem, they do the will of Hashem, and they rise to such a height that no nation in the world could rule over them or overpower them in the slightest. But when they turn away from Hashem, Hashem in turn hands them over to the lowest form of a nation. Even the lowest nation of the Goyim rules over them. Not only that, even the animals of those nations rule over them. Imagine this tzaddiket now has to degrade herself to go among the dirty Arab animals. Their dirt, to go pick drops of oats for herself. The Gemara asks, how could we say that, how could we even think, suspect that Adimo ben Gurion was so holy and tzaddik that his, for his sake, the sun shone especially, just as the sun shone for Yehoshua, the sun shone for Moshe Rabbeinu, so did the sun shine especially prolonged for Natimo Ben Gurion. These are the only three people for whom this miracle occurred. One who was so great, one who was so great in the mitzvah of tzedakah, how can we say that he lost his money because he did not give tzedakah? The Gemara answers, of course he did give tzedakah. You know that when he went out of his home to the Bet Midrash, they had special carpets laid out for him. Expensive carpets. And when he came to the Bet Midrash, he left those carpets behind. The poor would come and roll those carpets up with whatever was in them and take that. This was just one of his acts for giving charity to the poor. But the amounts he gave were tremendous. How can we say he didn't give any to that guy? He lost money because of lack of to that guy. The man answers two reasons. One, because he gave to that guy for the sake of kavod. He wanted to show how much he's giving. Second, even if it was not for the sake of kavod, the fact remains that when you place a burden on a camel, you measure off how much that camel can carry. That's how much, that's the weight you put on the camel. You don't put a 5,000-pound weight on a camel that can carry 1,000 pounds, and you don't put a 50-pound weight on a camel that can carry 500 pounds. You put the weight in ratio to the power, the strength of the camel. Now, every person must carry his burden, his weight. A rich person is expected to give more to that guy than a poor person. He's got to carry his weight. So if, like Dilma Ben Gurion gave $100,000 to tzedakah, that may be very much for an ordinary person, maybe far to reach for a regular person. But for his class, his status, for his wealth, that was not sufficient. We judge a person in ratio to his wealth. How much he was supposed to give, this was not sufficient. And that's why he was punished. He lost all his money. So we don't judge by the amount that a person gave, but by the percentage. We say ma'aser, we say achomish, it's the percentage of the earnings, or the wealth of a person that he's required to give tzedakah. If he fails to give that percentage, he has not fulfilled the mitzvah of tzedakah. The Gemara says that when speaking about those poor who come before the Jewish courts, if an orphan male and an orphan female, boy and girl come to the court, Hebrew court, they ask to be fed, be provided with food. The law is that if there is enough to give to only one of them, you must give it to the girl first. If there's any left, you can give it to the boy. If not, the boy is out of luck. Why does the girl come first? Because it is not proper for a girl to go around door to door begging. A boy or a man could do that. For a girl, it is not tzniut. It's not modesty. So therefore, since a man can go begging from door to door, he must first provide for the girl orphan, and then if there's any left over, give it to the boy. If not, let him go begging. Same thing, too, if we have to marry off an orphan who doesn't have parents, the bet din wants to contribute the money for it, that orphan to marry them off. If they find a case of a boy or a girl, two of them, not to each other, but two separate cases. We have to provide money for one or the other, and the girl comes first, because the embarrassment of the girl and not being able to get married, have to delay the wedding because of lack of funds is much greater than the embarrassment of the boy or the embarrassment of the girl. Having to find a chatan is much greater than the boy's. The girl cannot go out to seek. It's the duty, the ability of a boy. The girl is passive. And that's why in this case, both for food and for marrying off, the girl comes first. In either event, we must strive to provide for those who are in need. As Nav Tzedakah is so great that the Gemara says, Yerushalayim, which has been destroyed, will be redeemed again, rebuilt again, and the chut of that Nav Tzedakah, v'yat Mashiach Kenem, and Av Yameinu, Amen v'Yameinu.